Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Okay, and we are recording. And I'm lucky enough to have with me today Brad Marshall, who is a former cancer researcher who now raises and sells the meat from pigs raised in a very special way that he sells on firebrandmeats.com. So thanks very much for joining us today, Brad.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's exciting. It's fun.
I first heard about you on Twitter. It was an exchange around the so-called croissant diet, which is fascinating, and we can get into that later. Why don't you just start with your story? You know, tell us a bit about your background and how you got to where you are around food and nutrition.
Sure. So, like you say, I have a genetics degree from Cornell. And after college, I was working in labs. I worked at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And after that, I was at the Berkeley Drosophila Genome Project, doing basic cancer research. But I've always loved food and cooking. And so around that time, while I was in New York and while I was in California, I was spending a lot of time going to farmers markets and getting more and more involved in that world. And I went to the French Culinary Institute when I was in New York. I was always really intrigued by that side of things. And the lab work, although interesting, I kind of realized maybe wasn't what I wanted to do long term. I didn't like the sort of, I guess, physical inactivity of it. And so ultimately, I grew up in upstate New York, which is very rural. And ultimately, I ended up coming back to New York and I bought a farm in Trumansburg, which is near Ithaca, which is where Cornell is. So it's kind of close to my college roots. And I started doing a lot of things. But one of the things I did that I liked the most was to raise pigs. And so we started raising pigs, started selling them at farmers market. And with my kind of culinary background, we were able to do things like locally made pâtés and fancy sausages. And, you know, I was curing and smoking my own bacon, and we were doing pulled pork and all kinds of things that you don't often see at a farmer's market. And eventually that grew into a retail butcher shop and a USDA inspected meat processing facility, which is its whole own. If you really like getting involved in paperwork and bureaucracy, start a USDA inspected facility. It's great. So I really have, I got a whole background in pigs. And what was kind of unique about the way we were doing it is that I was raising the pigs on my farm and I was working with them in the butcher shop. And so I could see really dramatically how the breeds of pigs that I raised and what I fed them affected the quality of the fat. And so that was just something that I knew this from reading, like, if you read old texts, I like old farming texts and old culinary texts. And, you know, there was, if you read texts from like the year 1885, they talk a lot about all the different, you know, back then they were a lot more creative about what you could feed pigs. Today, everybody thinks you just have to feed them corn and soy. And if you try to feed them anybody else, everyone thinks you're crazy. you know, back then you could read, like, they used to feed them these things called chufas, which are like a little, it's a little tuber, and it's a sedge. They used to grow them in the American South. I don't think they're from the Americas initially. And the pigs would dig them up and eat them. And they did the same thing with peanuts. They would grow peanuts and the pigs would dig up the peanuts. But the problem with chufas or peanuts is that they give the pigs soft pork. And the problem with soft pork back then is that it's too hard to slice into bacon. Like, the bacon isn't firm enough and you can't make good slices out of it. And so also, if you read those old books, they talk a lot about how American bacon and American pork bellies didn't fetch a good price in European markets because the bulk of pigs in the US were fed pork. Even back then, they were still fed pork mostly. And pork is oilier than barley. And the classic
corn, the pork was fed pork. Do you mean it was fed corn?
Right. It was fed corn in the US. And corn has something like 2 to 3 times the amount of polyunsaturated fat or linoleic acid as does barley. And corn doesn't grow well in the north or too far north. And so like in Europe, a lot of the traditional grain fed to pigs is barley, you know, especially up in like Denmark, which exports a lot of grain into the rest, or a lot of pork into the rest of Europe. And so the classic European pork was actually barley fed, and barley fed pork is quite nice and it's quite firm, especially from, you know, the older fashioned breeds that you would have been raising in the year 1900. Right. So if you go back to 1900, you can find all these quotes that, you know, American pork is soft and doesn't fetch a good value, you know. And then you look at the ag tax and they're like, yeah, well, if you feed them these oily things like chufas and peanuts, the pork is even softer than the normal American corn-fed pork. And so, you know, we've known for, 130 years that the soft oils of, you know, vegetable oils, basically, if you feed them to pigs, the pigs will essentially be made of those vegetable oils and their fat will get soft. And so that's what I've been thinking about in the butcher shop as I've raised these pigs and fed them different things and then seen them in the butcher shop. You're like, wow, the difference is dramatic. And then I see other farms bring in their stuff, and it's just, you know, the difference in the pork is night and day. And so that's what I've been, you know, sort of doing, right, in my kind of day job for the last 15 years or so. But then also during that same time, you know, I've long been, I read, I think, the Dr. Atkins book back in like 2002 or so, roughly. I've struggled with my weight my whole life, as has most of my family. And so, you know, I've done on and off, I've done ketogenic diets, or what I called the Atkins diet back then, many times in my life, to try to maintain my weight. And I've been mostly a low carb guy, but also extraordinarily busy. And, you know, sometimes you just eat what there is, right? And so, so I realized that by the time I was, you know, 40, in my 43 or 44, you know, I gained significant weight. And, you know, I'd done that by eating a lot of restaurant food and, you know, the way that people do. And so I've always been an admirer of the blog Hyperlipid, which is, you know, gaining a lot more notoriety these days. But it's a very dense with science. And what he talks about is, well, to vastly oversimplify it, what he talks about is the fattening effect of linoleic acid, which is the exact same thing that I was seeing working its way into the pork fat and working its way into the chicken fat and working its way into, you know, the fried eggs that I would order at the diner, because we were also running a restaurant, and at my restaurant, I didn't use any, I didn't use any vegetable oils. They were strictly off limits, but when I go to the, you know, the restaurant warehouse, you know, you see the 5 gallon jugs of soybean oil and canola oil. So because I was in that industry, you just see it happening, you know, and I know other cooks and other chefs and, you know, and you go to like, you go to the back of house of what are really nice high-end restaurants serving like local foods. And, you know, there's their jugs of soybean oil sitting there. Right. And so, you know, we see it in, obviously if you buy, you know, potato chips, tortilla chips, you know, the classic junk food at the grocery store, it's on the label. But when you buy fried eggs at a diner, you're not thinking, oh, I'm ordering soybean oil, but that's what they cook them in. And so anyway, so I was seeing all of these ways that, that saturated fats are potentially coming in, all these Trojan horses, and how many I probably had been consuming while reading the blog Hyperlipid. And one of the things that's so one of the really interesting experiments on there is this woman, Valerie Reeves, did her thesis, and she showed that in mice fed a diet of basically starch and stearic acid, which is a long chain saturated fat, the mice became very thin and lost a lot of abdominal fat. And there's a lot of other data points that point to this, but the mice given starch with unsaturated fats were much heavier and weighed a lot more than the mice given starch and only saturated fat. And so when I read that, and like I say, I had initially gone keto, I think it was January of 2019. I weighed myself and I was very overweight, and I said I got to lose the weight. And so I started doing keto, and it worked a little bit, but not nearly as effectively as when I was, you know, in my 20s, right? And so I was losing a little bit of weight, but it was very slow. And I looked at Valerie Reeves' thesis and saw that mixture of starch and saturated fat. And I thought to myself that as a chef, that looks like how you make croissants. And so, you know, and thus the croissant diet was born. And I thought, I'm actually going to try this. I'm going to eat what the mice ate that made the mice lean. And so I started making these croissants, and I was making with butter, but I bought commercial stearic acid, and I was combining the two to make this really firm fat that I was folding into these croissants. And I started eating.
Sorry to interrupt, but just for the non-chefs, you kind of make puff pastry with layers of flour, butter, and some salt, right? And then there's not much else to it.
Yeah, exactly. That's really all that it is. And you know, if you look at the macro ratios, right? The best croissant recipes, the real traditional croissants, are like probably, you know, 2/3 of the calories are from fat. And so people probably in the low carb community are probably thinking about a croissant as being this very, you know, starchy, carby thing, but really it's only, you know, 25-30% of the calories are from carbs. So, you know, a croissant is really much more of a high fat food than it is a high carb food. But it obviously contains more carbs than someone on a super low carb diet is going to perhaps want to eat. But I also knew that, well, it's not that much. And so anyway, so that's why I went with croissants, because I wanted to use the same, you know, the mice in the study weren't getting 2/3 of their calories as fat. They were only getting, you know, 40% or something like that. But from my perspective, I wanted to keep it as low carb as possible while using similar types of fats as I had seen in some of these other papers, you know. And there's other, there's another paper where that I don't think is on my blog, but it's on Hyperlipid, where that he posted pretty recently, where they did the same thing with mice, and one of them got, one group got cocoa butter and another group got olive oil and some other less saturated fats. And the cocoa butter mice are very lean again. And so, so there's a lot of data points that support this idea that the types of fat that you're eating make a huge difference ultimately on your weight. And so, yeah. And so I started making these croissants, and they're very high
just
in fat.
Asked,
and they were,
sorry to interrupt again, but
no, it's okay.
I'm curious. And I would just point out from an N equals one that when I eat a lot of dark chocolate, there's some sugar in there, but of course it's overwhelmingly fat and cocoa butter with plenty of stearic acid in there. And I find that my weight is probably easier to control when I eat a lot of that. Not true with, you know, lots of cheese and cream. So I think there's obviously hormonal signaling going on, and I'd be interested to know what commercial stearic acid looks like, because I would imagine if I had to guess that it's similar to beef dripping or beef tallow, that it's solid at room temperature and kind of white in color. Is that right?
Yes, it is white in color, but when you remove, so something like beef drippings are roughly 50-50 saturated and monounsaturated, with a little bit of polyunsaturated in there. And the saturated fats have the highest melting point. And so when you, you know, because like olive oil, right, is mostly monounsaturated fat, it's a liquid at room temperature. And so what happens is when you remove the monounsaturated and the polyunsaturated fats out of the blend, the melting point becomes very high. So the melting point of stearic acid is like 170 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, I don't know what that is in Celsius, but it's, you know, it's very much higher than body temperature. So if you put stearic acid in your mouth, you know, with M&Ms, they say melt in your mouth, not in your hand, but stearic acid won't melt in your hand or in your mouth. It's just going to stay as wax.
It's 76 degrees Celsius. So that's probably a little bit too hot to touch.
Right. Exactly. No, you wouldn't want to touch it when it was melted. And, if you do, it'll just immediately turn to wax on your fingers though. You know, if you touch it while it's liquid. And it's not absorbed very well in the pure form. There are studies with, you know, feeding people like granulated stearic acid, and I think you do absorb a little. Some of the studies I saw said like 17% of it is absorbed, which I'm almost a little surprised that any of it's absorbed. But the stomach is obviously very acidic, and there are bile acids to help emulsify things like fats. So a lot of people, this is a common question I get all the time, is can I just eat the stearic acid? And someone was posting on Twitter last night about fasting and using basically stearic acid flakes in water, just chugging them down as to help with the fast. And he said it was helping. So I'm a little torn on the question of, should I just eat stearic acid straight? I would say no. I wouldn't think it's going to do anything. You're not going to absorb much of it. It's just going to pass right through, but I could be wrong on that. But that's why I was, baking with it and mixing it with butter to get it to, you know, because when it's in a mixture, it's a lot easier to absorb it and actually, you know, take it in. And that's why I was baking it into the starches, because that helps to, I think that helps it be absorbed, it, you know, when it's bound to starch. I just think it's easier, rather than just in little pellets, I think it's easier for your body to absorb it. That's my sort of running assumption. But I also, you know, croissants are tasty, so there's that.
And so what happened when you started making these custom croissants that were kind of made to be like that mouse study? What was the experience?
So I started losing weight right away. And even more so than weight, I lost inches off my waist and off of my belly. You know, my pants became very, very loose, very in just a matter of weeks. And
is that all you were eating?
Well, that and the wine. So I'm a wine drinker. I'm an unapologetic wine drinker. And so, I was eating, I was making, these croissant sandwiches, right? And that was pretty much what for the first, month or so of doing the croissant diet, I was eating these croissant sandwiches and,
what was in the sandwiches?
So I would put like, breakfast sausage, and that was from pigs that I'd grown, so it was fairly low in polyunsaturated fat breakfast sausages. And I would fry an egg or two in butter and melt cheese on there, and then I would spread the croissants, which were already, you know, very high in butter and stearic acid. I would spread another layer of butter on them, and like I was eating these little sandwiches, and I found them to be incredibly filling and satiating at first. That was my first response. Was like, wow, that's it. And I've never been a person to have a strong satiation response. This has been discussed a lot on Twitter, but you know, I've always been a person who eventually it's like, well, I already went up for thirds, I'm still kind of hungry, you know. And so I didn't have that kind of strong experience of just like, I don't want anymore. It's like, I'm not, like physically my stomach doesn't feel full, but I just don't want to / can't eat anymore. Like I'm done. And so that's not an experience that I'd had before in my life. And also I started missing meals afterwards, which was another thing that there was a couple times I just literally forgot to make dinner. And that was certainly nothing that I had ever experienced in my life. So that's when I kind of realized I was onto something. I have the scientific background, obviously, and I'd already written, you know, so I started my blog, Fire in a Bottle. And basically what I was doing was in the fall of 2019, I was working my way through the Protons thread of the blog Hyperlipid.
And now for anyone who's not read Hyperlipid or the Protons thread, it's a series of blog posts which kind of incorporates and takes its jumping off point as the origins of life, as Nick Lane sees it in his book, The Vital Question, where you have these deep sea vents and the gradient of energy production in cells forming billions of years ago. It's like a very deep theory about where life itself comes from potentially. And the theory is, you know, really that it happened once and that's where all life comes from. And that the proton thread drives into the evolution of that and the evolution of us and the evolution of ourselves and how the deep implications that follow from that, one of which is that saturated fat is exquisitely matched to our mitochondria to make energy with, which is probably, to me, the most important conclusion from the whole blog, is that saturated fat is an exquisite fuel for human cells.
Yeah, and yes, exactly. And so I was, like I say, I was trying to understand the science of hyperlipid myself, because it's not easy to jump into and there's a lot of jargon. And so I was going through and reading all the terms. And as I was reading it and learning it for myself, I was thinking somebody should write a layperson's guide to hyperlipid so that someone could read this and try to understand it without as much of a science background. And then eventually I thought, well, maybe I should write it. And so that was really, the origins of my idea for my blog. And so I wrote a series called Introduction to Oxidation. And then I wrote a series called the ROS Theory of Obesity, that tried as much as possible to take the protons thread and explain it in a more, you know, a little bit more approachable fashion. I think I succeeded to some extent. And so, you know, and it provides a little more of the background knowledge, like things like how your body's internal antioxidant system works. I think that's something that surprises people to learn that, like, oh, we make our own antioxidants. I thought antioxidants came from plants. And it's like, no, we have a very robust antioxidant system. And so, you know, without that, we wouldn't be able to exist in an oxygenated atmosphere. Oxygen is obviously quite corrosive, as we can see from the fires going on in California and Australia. And in fact, fire tornadoes, which I reference in the very first post on my blog, there was one in 2018 in California. The heat from the fires, from one of the fires, became so intense that the air was rising and turning, and I think they measured like 148 mile an hour winds in this vortex of fire that happened in California and literally leapt across a river that they thought would contain the fire, but they didn't expect an actual tornado to form. Anyway, this year, I think there's been two or three more of these fire tornadoes. I was using it to make a point about, you know, how potentially, you know, explosive the existence of atmospheric oxygen is and how we had to evolve to deal with that, and sort of made the broad picture point that on some level, life, you know, all of oxygenated life, this is what's happening. Plants are taking the energy of the sun and they are essentially stripping electrons away from oxygen molecules. Oxygen is there in the form of water, H2O, and carbon dioxide, CO2. Oxygen is very happy in those configurations. It's very stable. And what the plants are doing is it's forcing the oxygen, instead of, you know, oxygen is kind of a bully and it takes the electrons away from the other thing. So in the form of H2O, the hydrogens are getting a very small share of the electrons and the oxygen basically owns them. The same with CO2. Oxygen is, the two oxygens are basically pulling the electrons away from the carbon. And in those configurations, the oxygen is really controlling the electrons and that makes oxygen happy. But the plants in the chloroplast use the energy of the sun to make the two oxygens share electrons with each other as this O2, which is oxygen that we breathe. And the oxygen is not, it's not super happy in that configuration. It's remarkably kind of metastable. Obviously it's 12% or 20% in the air and we're not all on fire. So like somehow it works, but the potential is there for real, mayhem. So in my big overarching thing I drew one time, I don't really think this is on my blog, but this idea that, you know, chloroplasts are stripping electrons away from oxygen and then the electrons flow back to the oxygen in our mitochondria. So that's the big high level reaction that's taking place is somehow, yeah, the plants take the electrons away from oxygen and our mitochondria allow the electrons to flow back down to oxygen. And so that's really the big picture, right? And so that has a lot of implications, and that is really what, that's sort of the background that you need to understand when you think about the hyperlipid, the protons thread idea and how it works. And so, so what happens is in the mitochondria, as metabolism is happening, there's these electron transport chains in the wall or in the membrane of the mitochondria. And what they're doing is,
this is like the way I think about it is it's like a factory conveyor belt, and you literally have rotating devices which are used to transport the electron that you're talking about, right?
Right. And so through a series of chemical reactions, known as the TCA cycle or the Krebs cycle, electron carriers, they call them, but there's molecules like NADH and FADH2. And what they're doing is they're basically taking electrons from things like glucose and they're transferring them to the electron transport chain. And the electrons move through this transport chain from complex one to complex three to complex four. And every time it moves to the next, the next component of the chain, it pumps a proton from the inside of the mitochondria to the outside. And so every time an electron moves through, you have like two or three protons that get pumped across this membrane. And then what happens at the end is now the mitochondria becomes like this little charged battery. So you've got it's positive on the outside and it's negative on the inside. So because you have this, this electric potential difference, the protons want to flow back through this thing called complex five, which, like you say, that's the big whirling thing that's literally turning that that electrical energy into mechanical energy, and it uses that to add a phosphate group to an ADP, adenosine diphosphate, and turn it into an ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And so
that is the basic unit of energy that the body uses, right, to do everything.
Right. So your muscle cells use ATP to move us around. That third phosphate group is a very high energy bond, and so the body is good at breaking that bond and using that energy that's released to do most of the things that we do, right? Mostly our metabolism runs on ATP. And so that's the basis of how it works. And then there's this signal, and this, like you say, I'm glad you introduced this by talking about the origins of life, because when we think about a cell, what it is we have these internal membranes and these internal organelles. And what it looks like is that at some point in time, we had a cell and it sort of engulfed through a process of phagocytosis. Another little microorganism became essentially embedded inside of another cell. And instead of digesting it as a cell normally would do, for whatever reason, that one looks like it took up residence inside of that other cell. And so that's why when you look at a mitochondria, it actually has two membranes. It has an inner and an outer membrane. And so a mitochondria presumably at one point was a separate free living organism that came to live inside of a cell. And then we all evolved from that first event where, one cell came to live inside of another cell. So that's kind of a miraculous thing, but it brings up the question of, okay, but then how does the nucleus of the cell, which is, where the first cell that engulfed the other one, how does the nucleus know what the mitochondria is doing? They have to have a way of talking to each other. And so if you look, what happens is in the first case scenario where we're where the mitochondria is oxidizing glucose or metabolizing glucose, mostly it's producing the electron transporter NADH. So you've got a lot of NADH, and they're feeding their electrons into complex one of the electron transport chain. And the electron transport chain runs very efficiently that way. All of the electrons are used to pump protons, and they all flow back down to oxygen, and everything's hunky-dory. But if the cell switches over to metabolizing saturated fat, what happens is there's a second carrier called FADH2. Whenever you are oxidizing saturated fats, you're making a lot more FADH2. And what happens is FADH2 feeds into complex 2 of the electron transport chain. And electron and complex 1 and complex 2 both hand their electron to complex 3. So what happens is you've got a bottleneck there. You know, it's just like two on-ramps of cars onto the freeway. And if one on-ramp is full of cars, they get on the freeway, no problem. But when both on-ramps are full, all of a sudden you've got a traffic jam. And so this is just a literal traffic jam, bottleneck, however you want to think about it. If both things are feeding into the electron transport chain, complex 3 simply gets overwhelmed. And when that happens, those electrons, they ping back out as this free electron, and they create a molecule called superoxide. So that's when an oxygen will take on this extra electron that's just kind of freely available. And like I say, oxygens love to take electrons. And so now you have this negatively charged oxygen with an unpaired electron in its outer shell. And so that makes it a free radical. In addition, it's a free radical ion. And that is known as superoxide. So on my blog, I have little drawings of oxygen with the little dot and the minus symbol, like wearing a cape, because it's superoxide. And I give them a little mohawk because it's a radical. I think humor is important for all of this. And so that superoxide is converted very quickly. We make a enzyme called superoxide dismutase, which is another kind of fun word. But superoxide dismutase is actually the fastest enzyme that we have. So it can literally, as fast as superoxide can diffuse to come into contact with a superoxide dismutase can turn it into peroxide, hydrogen peroxide, H2O2. And so very rapidly, the superoxide produced in the mitochondrial membrane is converted to hydrogen peroxide. And hydrogen peroxide is a very interesting molecule because it's very small and it's water soluble, but since it's not charged and since it's small and since it's kind of fat soluble enough, it can actually diffuse through membranes. And so it can actually leave the mitochondria and diffuse into the rest of the cell. And that is how, this sort of signal from this bottleneck in the electron transport chain is communicated to the rest of the cell, is by hydrogen peroxide diffusing out of the mitochondria. And hydrogen peroxide is interesting in another way because it's not the term reactive oxygen species is a little confusing because we want to call them free radicals, but that's not really right because hydrogen peroxide isn't a free radical anymore. It doesn't have a unpaired electron in its outer shell. So it's not really, we can't really call them free radicals for that reason. But they are still, but hydrogen peroxide is still an oxidant, but it's not a strong enough oxidant. Some of the free radicals oxidants are explosive enough that they can do damage to your proteins, that they can do damage to your fats and like oxidize your like linoleic acid, for instance, the you know, the same thing that we get in our diet. Linoleic acid can be oxidized into what's called a lipid peroxide, and that can lead to this chain reaction that can ultimately end in like DNA damage, or it can make these protein adducts and cause all of this like downstream damage. But once things are converted into hydrogen peroxide, they don't do that anymore. Hydrogen peroxide isn't that reactive. And so hydrogen peroxide has very specific interactions with other proteins that are floating around, these signaling proteins. And it really, all it does is they have specific cysteine residues that have a sulfur, and sulfur can have multiple oxidation states. And so these hydrogen peroxides, what they're doing is all of these different enzymes basically have these little switches on them that are these sulfur amino acids. And so depending on the oxidation state of these sulfurs, the enzyme is either turned on or off. And so this is an old molecular switch, right? That's what we're looking at. This is like, okay, mitochondria burning glucose, no hydrogen or very little hydrogen peroxide is produced. All of the transcription factors and enzymes are doing one thing. Okay, now for whatever reason, maybe it's the absence of glucose, maybe it's another reason, but the mitochondria switches over, it now starts burning fat. Hydrogen peroxide is produced, these different signaling factors, transcription factors, their sulfurs get to a different oxidation state, and this causes a whole different set of things to happen, right? And so the cell can reconfigure itself based on whether or not it's metabolizing glucose or whether it's metabolizing fat. And this has been conserved since forever. And I talk about this experiment a lot because I really like it. But in a C. elegans worm, which is a tiny nematode that live in the ground, I think they have like 24 cells. So it's a very simple organism. And what happens is if you prevent it from being able to use glucose, it will switch over to burning its own body fat. And in response to that, it will actually live longer. And it'll live longer because it thinks it's not in an energetically favorable environment. It's like, I don't want to reproduce right now. I'm going to hang out until I find some glucose, because C. elegans live off of like plant roots. And so they're looking for plant roots that are giving them some glucose to eat. And so the C. elegans says, I'm going to look for a better source of energy for a few more days, because, you know, that hydrogen peroxide created in the mitochondria is the signal that glucose is around. Or in this case, I guess, lack of hydrogen peroxide would be the signal to the worm that glucose is plentiful. And so the worm decides to live a few days longer till it can find some glucose. And they only live like 18 days overall. So if you deprive them of glucose, they'll live for like 21 days. So not a very long-lived organism, but still it's significant. And so then if you deprive them of glucose and give them an antioxidant, they don't live the extra 3 days. They die right at 18 days where you expect them to. And what that shows is that it is indeed the production of superoxide and hydrogen peroxide that is the signal to the, you know, to the nucleus is of the cells of that organism that, okay, energy is low. We need to live the extra 3 days. We know the energy is low because we're making reactive oxygen species in our mitochondria. And if you use antioxidants to soak up those reactive oxygen species, then the signal is never delivered, and therefore the worms don't know that there's no glucose. They think they're burning glucose because they don't see any reactive oxygen species. And so that's why I often repeat the phrase, especially in the early parts of the blog, that ROS is the signal, right? The ROS is the signal from the mitochondria so that the rest of the organism can make its decisions about what it wants to do based on the metabolism of the organism, right? Okay, so that's all the background. So now we jump ahead into the modern world. Suddenly we're getting all of these polyunsaturated fats from soybean oil, from chicken fat, from pork fat, from, you know, restaurant cooking. We get it in all these places, you know, chips, processed foods, all the things. The problem with polyunsaturated fats is that they produce less FADH2 than saturated fats do. And so that means that there's not as much traffic at the bottleneck. The traffic jam is not as bad. And if the traffic jam isn't as bad, the mitochondria are not going to produce as much reactive oxygen species. So essentially, linoleic acid, you know, I like to pick on linoleic acid. Really, any polyunsaturated fat will have the same effect. It's just that linoleic acid is like probably 85% of the polyunsaturated fats that we actually eat. It's the one that's actually, you know, prevalent in soybean oil and corn oil and ultimately in chicken and pork fat because of what we feed them. But so the problem with the polyunsaturated fats is that they break the switch. This ancient feedback loop of the mitochondria producing ROS in response to being asked to metabolize linoleic acid means that this signal that's been, you know, evolutionarily conserved for a billion years with a B, it doesn't work anymore when you feed the organism linoleic acid. And so that is hugely important, because how can your metabolism function efficiently if the most basic evolutionarily conserved signal about what type of energy you're burning is eliminated? You know, that sounds like a real problem, doesn't it? So at the heart of that protons thread is this idea that you're messing with something that is an absolute building block of our metabolism every time that you eat these polyunsaturated fats. And so I am starting to think that is at the root cause. You know, obviously I've been in the low carb community for a long time, and everybody talks about carbohydrates and how they're bad, but you know, I look at that and I think maybe the root of the problem is not carbohydrates per se, but the fact that, you know, this linoleic acid has kind of screwed up our whole metabolism. And because of that, you know, we don't, it's like the organism isn't understanding how to switch back and forth between fat and starch correctly. So if we just remove all of the starch, that might cure a lot of the symptoms, because now there is no starch ever. So we just kind of stay in this one mode, and that seems to work out okay. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the starch caused the problem in the first place. And so the other thing is, I love, as a chef, I like, you know, like I say, I like food. I like food history, and I like just how it affects people. And so the other part that's kind of affected my thinking is like my understanding of basic French cuisine. And you go back and you look at, you know, photos of, anybody can do this. Go on Google and search for, like, go to Google Images and look for photos of Paris in the year 1970. You know, there's so little obesity. And if you just look at like casual street scenes and find photos of older people, there's just very little obesity in, you know, in France, or search for France in the 1970s, you know. And they were eating, they absolutely were eating, and there's plenty of evidence. You go to FAO stat, you can Google what every country was eating in every year since 1961. And so, you know, the French people in 1970 absolutely were and had been eating flour and sugar, qu- quite a bit of sugar. In fact, something like 400 calories a day of sugar and butter, and cheese and beef and pork. And so they were eating fat with starch, and everyone was lean, and they were drinking wine. Of course, they were the French. And it's like, okay, how do you explain that? Because everybody in the low carb community right now would say the worst thing that you can do is combine fat and starch. But yet there are numerous counterexamples, such as France. And I picked the year 1970 because, you know, obviously France was devastated in 1940, right? So if we look at 1950, it's like, well, I was immediately post-war, you know. And by the 1980s, the French were starting to eat a lot more vegetable oils, especially sunflower seed oil. They seemed to really like, and these days the French are eating lots more sunflower seed oil, and now they're getting fat, right? So you can see the you can see the trends there. But in the 1970s, they still really weren't eating much vegetable oil. You know, they'd had basically a full generation to recover from the war. And it's a really interesting snapshot, right, of a time and place, sort of sufficient time to recover from the war, but hadn't incorporated vegetable oils yet. That's why I picked the specific year, France, of 1970.
It's funny how you know, the so-called French paradox has been used a lot by the low-carb community to point out that the fact that saturated fat consumption is traditionally very high in France, and heart disease researchers for the last 50 years have been obsessed with LDL cholesterol as a proposed cause, you know, have this so-called French paradox because the French have low heart disease rates and high rates of saturated fat consumption. But it's interesting now that there's a potentially French paradox to the low carb community idea of requiring to eliminate all sugar and starch in order to remain lean.
Right. Exactly. And so it's sort of like, it's kind of a new French paradox, but it is, you know, there are many low carb diet supporters that will say the last thing you should do is combine starch and fat, right? That's what's thought. I think it's hard to support that on an historical basis. And that is where I had always, you know, as a low carb supporter, but also as a fat person my whole life, and also as a food historian who went to the French Culinary Institute, and I knew that, you know, it's cognitive dissonance, right? It's like, how do I justify these two worlds that I both believe in very much, but I can't put them together, you know? And so as I was reading Hyperlipid, thinking about all these things and thinking about the ROS production and how it all works, I was literally in the car on the way to my mom's house and or my family's house. My dad also lives there, but it's my mom's house to be sure. But I was, you know, I had nephews coming, etc. And I was sitting in the car and I was thinking this all over, and I had this, like, you know, eureka moment when I realized that Peter's proton thread actually explains this kind of French paradox, right? And I was like, oh my God, it all makes sense all of a sudden. And I went home and I very excitedly explained it to my family about the mitochondria and the ROS, and they all just kind of like stared blankly back at me. I don't think they got it, but yeah, I just think that this is you know, I think this can explain a lot about how to stitch these different worldviews back together in a sort of, you know, I guess unified theory or something. Physicists are still struggling to combine the Newtonian physics with subatomic physics, right? There's like got to be some law that like brings it all together. But I kind of think the proton thread might actually do that in the nutrition field. And that's why, yeah, obviously that's why I'm excited about talking about it. And I guess we haven't really fully brought it home. Right. Now we've talked about the actual ROS and why they're produced in response to saturated fat. It's because of the increased FADH2 to NADH ratio. Okay, fine. So how does that work now scaling up from a C. elegans worm to a human? Okay, so now we have different tissues and we've got enzymes circulating around and we've got hormones circulating around. And now we're eating saturated fat in, you know, the context of this multicellular organism. So now we're eating this fat. It's going into our bloodstream as these things called chylomicrons. And so these are produced in your gut, essentially, from your dietary fat. And they're like little circulating droplets of fat with a membrane around them. And those circulate through your bloodstream, and they, in your capillaries, they produce something called LPL, which is lipoprotein lipase. And those circulating little balls of fat essentially will dock where there's LPL, and start to unload their cargo, and the cells take them in and start doing metabolism. And so your dietary fat is directed to specific tissues by the presence of this hormone or this enzyme called LPL. And the thing that produces that LPL the most strongly is actually your abdominal fat. And so after a meal, that your dietary fat is targeted very specifically to your abdominal fat. And so your abdominal fat will take up your dietary fat, start metabolizing it. If it's mostly saturated fat, your belly fat will start producing ROS. It's going to start burning that dietary fat, and it's going to start producing ROS. And what the ROS is doing is it is oxidizing the sulfur residues, just like we talked about. It's oxidizing those specific sulfurs, which is the signal from the hydrogen peroxide, and those enzymes are shut off. And what those, I shouldn't call them enzymes, they're signaling molecules. And what the specific ones that are turned off by the hydrogen peroxide are the ones that transmit the signal from insulin to the nucleus. And so in fat cells that are burning saturated fat, they stop listening to insulin, or they become insulin resistant, or a state which Peter refers to as physiological insulin resistant. And so specifically, your abdominal fat tissue becomes insulin resistant in response to a meal very high in saturated fat. And of course, this isn't whole body insulin resistance. The kind of whole body insulin resistance you see in type 2 diabetes is like that's a totally different state. This is very specific, it's targeted, and it serves a purpose, and it's normal physiology. Because what are the things, what does insulin actually do at normal physiological levels? This is kind of a surprising thing that actually Tommy Woods pointed out to me recently, that at normal physiological levels, most of the time, insulin's job is not to push glucose into cells and upregulate for the glucose transport. The job of insulin is to stop your fat cells from doing lipolysis. it does a couple of other things too. It turns off glucagon and it shuts off gluconeogenesis in the liver, and then it stops lipolysis. And so lipolysis is the process by which your fat cells release their stored fat and release it into the blood as things called free fatty acids. And those free fatty acids are a fuel source for the rest of the body. So insulin is telling your fat cells, hey, we've got energy coming in from the diet, so you can stop feeding the rest of your body fat, right? That's the job of insulin. And so if your fat cells are very insulin sensitive, what they're going to do is every time you eat, insulin's going to be produced and your fat cells are going to stop feeding the rest of the body. They're going to stop releasing fat, and they're going to do it for a long time if they're very insulin sensitive. And so, you know, so this is about degrees and it's about levels. Like your fat cells are never going to be 100% insulin responsive or 100% insulin resistance. They're going to be, you know, 40% insulin resistant or 70% insulin resistant, right? So you should, normal physiology is that after a meal, the level of free fatty acids in your blood drops, which is to say that in response to a meal, your fat cells to some degree will stop doing lipolysis. But there's a study on my blog that I talk about a lot, and I actually just found, I've been meaning to post this, another study that totally reconfirms this same experiment. It was a study done in Spain, and they gave people a meal of, it was mostly fat. One group got butter, one group got olive oil, and other groups got vegetable oil. And what happens is, so in all groups, after this meal, their levels of free fatty acids drop. Their levels of blood glucose go up by a bit, not much because there wasn't a lot of carbohydrate in the meal. But they all release insulin. Free fatty acids drop for a couple of hours. But in the group given the butter, the free fatty acids never drop as much in the first place, and they rebound, and they actually end up going higher than they were before the meal by, like, I think 4 hours after the meal. So when you think about people who are, you know, can't go more than 3 hours without eating, right? And it's like, oh, I just ate, you know, I ate something, and then it's 3 hours later, I'm hungry again, I got to eat again, and then 3 hours after that, they're eating again, and then they have to have a snack. And it's like, well, why is that happening? And my, you know, the question I've asked myself the whole life is, if I'm fat, why am I hungry? And so if your fat cells are really, really insulin sensitive, that means that what's going to happen is that 3 hours after a meal, so you eat, your blood glucose goes up. I think this gets into discussion of satiety or satiety. When do we feel full? And the hypothalamus plays a big role in this, and I'm no expert on the hypothalamus, and I'm not, trying to be, but I mean, maybe someday I'm sure I'll learn more about it. But one of the things, you know, what is the hypothalamus doing that makes us feel full or not full? And it's basically monitoring the amounts of circulating fuels that we have available to us. So if it sees high blood glucose along with free fatty acids and other circulating fuels, such as probably ketones or ethanol, it's going to signal, okay, we're not really hungry right now, right? There's no need for hunger. Back to the person who is having to snack every 3 hours. So they're eating, whatever they're eating. Let's say they're eating a a croissant, but it's a crappy American one made with soybean oil, which a lot of them are. So they're eating that, and due to the high linoleic acid content of their meal, you know, we could say potato chips. That's an even better example. So they eat some potato chips. Their blood glucose level goes up. So now they're feeling, for the moment, they've had some potato chips. They're not feeling hunger anymore because they have blood glucose available. Hypothalamus is saying, great, looks good. We've got plenty of energy. Don't need to eat. What's going to happen is over the next 2 to 3 hours, you know, they're going to absorb that blood glucose. Their blood glucose is going to return back to what it was before the meal, or in some cases, it even goes lower. If those potato chips were cooked in soybean oil, their fat cells, their adipocytes, are going to remain very insulin sensitive, which means they're going to stop releasing free fatty acids to the rest of the body. So now you had this person that who had some like baseline level of free fatty acids and blood glucose. They ate some chips. Now we move forward 3 hours. Now their blood glucose has returned to what it was, but the free fatty acids are below what they were before the meal. So now due to the fact that they've eaten 3 hours after the meal, they actually have less circulating energy levels than before the meal. You see, so precisely because they've eaten, the hypothalamus is saying, oh, we've got a lack of energy here, guys. Like, because the blood glucose is now out of the system, but the free fatty acids are through the floor, right? And so now you're ravenous. You've got to eat again because you don't have any free fatty acids because your fat cells are insulin sensitive. Now let's flip the script. Okay, so now we're eating croissants instead of potato chips fried in soybean oil. Same scenario. Same thing happens. You eat the croissant. You're not hungry right now. Blood glucose goes up. By about 3 hours later, it's probably back to baseline. But now, because you've eaten butter instead of soybean oil, your free fatty acids didn't drop as much in the first place, and they've actually rebounded. And in the case of the butter, the free fatty acids actually go higher than they were by 3 to 4 hours. And so now, 3 hours later, because you've eaten the croissant, you're less hungry than you were before because your blood glucose is the same, but your free fatty acids are higher. And so that, I think, you know, when you look at those graphs of how free fatty acids change in response to a meal, and when you think about eating patterns and people that you see who have to eat every 2 to 3 hours, if we think about that hunger and satiety being driven by just simply the hypothalamus trying to measure how much energy that we have available to us, it makes a ton of sense, right? And the other thing that the hypothalamus is doing when it's giving you a satiety signal is it also expresses LPL. So your dietary fat is also directed to the hypothalamus. And so when you eat a butter croissant after the meal, your gut is it's releasing that fat into the bloodstream as chylomicrons. They're connecting with that LPL in the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus is taking in that fat and it's oxidizing it and it's creating ROS. And that ROS seems to be a kind of necessary component of the satiety signal. And so the hypothalamus is also taking in signals from things like leptin and other circulating hormones. So it's kind of like connecting a lot of pieces to give you satiation or not. But it seems like the ROS may be a necessary component of that to get that hard satiety cutoff switch. And so I suspect that the reason when I eat you know, a very high saturated fat meal, that could be the reason why I get to that point where I just don't want to, can't eat anymore, to the point sometimes of nausea if I try to push past it. You know, I think that could be because I probably my whole life had lots of circulating polyunsaturated fat. And so I wasn't hitting that. I wasn't generating sufficient ROS to get that satiety. And so when we eat a big fatty meal early in the meal, you know, the thing that's causing us to stop ingesting calories is a necessary component of that is ROS produced in the hypothalamus. And then after the meal, how our body, you know, responds to the meal in terms of 3 to 4 hours later with our free fatty acids being released, that is caused by ROS production in the adipose tissues, in the fat tissues. And so that's sort of my, like, that's my big picture of energy balance in the long term, how saturated fat is key to the whole thing and how it stops functioning once you get enough of the polyunsaturated fats.
That's a brilliant overall description of, you know, why it's really satiety that is the key in understanding successful eating habits and weight control, and why calories in, calories out is like a kind of preschool, kindergarten, glib, true, but almost irrelevant thing to say, is because of course it's calories in, calories out, but if you can't control satiety, then who cares? You know, because
right. You
won't control calories in properly.
Right. Well, and so a lot of people say, you know, people have all these different explanations to try to explain the French paradox, right? And why they remain lean. And a lot of people say, well, it's because they don't snack. To which I always say, yeah, but maybe they don't snack because they're not hungry. You know, it's like, why don't they snack? And I'm sure there's a cultural component to it, but if you're ravenous, you're going to snack. And so that's, yeah, it's like, yeah, why don't the French snack? That's the whole thing, right? If we can figure that out, then we can do the same.
Yes. And, you know, I suppose the thing that I'm very interested in as a food producer myself is, and a lover of a variety of meats, and something since in the last few years, discovering that linoleic acid is potentially extremely harmful in lots of different ways. Never mind the fact that it's not, you know, consuming it's not good for weight control. Chicken and pork fat, which ends up with a high level of linoleic acid if you feed the animal either directly that these kind of oils, which sometimes they are, if you know the commercial feeds have these types of oils added directly as a source of calories for them, and it just persists straight into their fat, or corn, which you said earlier, does the same thing. It's very interesting to me to think about commercially producing these animals where linoleic acid is you know, vastly reduced in their fat. It means that me and my customers can take advantage of that and enjoy chicken and pork again without worrying about either their satiety or their long-term health suffering because of it. So you know, what's the script with that?
Yeah, I mean, right. And so when we look at chicken and pork, and this is a very interesting historical question. And what do we feed them and why? So animals can't make polyunsaturated fat. Pigs can't, chickens can't, humans can't. So we can only get it from our diet, right? If we don't feed our chickens and pigs, polyunsaturated fats, they won't be full of it. So that's number one. And then number two is that, you know, genetics and feeds play a huge role. So, for instance, and we already talked about this, but, yeah, there was the classic barley finished pork. It's nice. It's firm and, you know, you can slice it. It was easy to manufacture. It fetched a higher value in European markets. And you see this in the US too. In the US for a long time, it was considered that, Canadian produced bacon, was the best bacon. And the reason again is that they're in the north and corn didn't historically grow well in the north. So in on the Canadian plains, they were raising barley and peas, and barley and peas are both really low in fat. And so that is a classic Northern European animal diet, and it's a classic you know, Canadian and you know, pig feed. And even in the northwestern US, like in Oregon and Washington State and Idaho, they were growing barley and peas, and to this day they still grow barley and peas there. And so historically you saw these parts of the world where, you know, the parts where they were mainly growing barley, that's where the firm pork fat was, and places that grew corn was softer. And so on my blog, Fire in a Bottle, there's an article called Disastrous Trends in American Bacon. And I went, again, I went to this thing called FAO Stat, which is from the UN. And they've got all this great data about what different countries ate, what they produced, what they exported. But what you can see is that if you go back to like 1960 in France, you know, the vast majority of grains, you have to look at kind of what they produce and what they export and what they import to kind of put it all together. So you have to look in these three different data sets. But you can see that in 1960 in France, for instance, the vast, vast majority of grain available to feed any livestock would have been barley. It was like 75% barley and like 25% corn. If you look today, that's flipped. Now France is 75% corn and 25% barley. And partly that's because there's, you know, I think a lot of that is just cultural. That's what Europe traditionally grew barley, and that was what it was. It's also, I think, because in the Green Revolution, they came up with corn that was easy to grow in more parts of the world. Although France isn't that far north, obviously, right? France is probably a great location to grow barley. It's more relevant in places like, you know, Denmark, which traditionally is a big pork exporter to the rest of Europe, or the UK. I don't know if more corn is being grown in the UK than it was traditionally. I think there are probably varieties that do better now than there were historically. I mean, do you see a lot of corn or soybeans being grown around you? Where are you in the UK?
I'm in Scotland, and there's a lot of oilseed rape being grown as a cash crop. And there's a lot of that kind of oil flying around. In terms of grain, I'm not sure of what the split is at the moment. Certainly in Scotland, I would be surprised if we get a lot of corn grown, because it's
right.
Getting quite far north there. But I'm not sure how much that influences what we feed to our pigs. And another thing, of course, is that places like Spain, where they, you know, could grow corn, I think a lot of the time the most prized pigs are allowed to forage under acorn trees. So they'll have brilliantly scented meat, but it'll be really high in linoleic acid because of those nuts. And you know, it's an interesting.
Well, let's unpack that for a second. I don't think you're totally wrong, but there's a couple of things happening. So The acorn finished pigs are very interesting. Now those are, and this is an interesting fact in and of itself. So there are different breeds of pigs, or different types of pigs, I should say. There are what back in the day we used to call lard pigs, and these were grown especially for their ability to put on lots and lots of fat. And then there are what were called bacon pigs, which is a leaner pig that was grown more for lean cuts. I say lean cuts because historically we're talking about a Berkshire, which is still a lot fattier than a modern kind of Landrace pink pig. But a bacon pig was kind of this intermediate. They produce a fair amount of lard, but they have bigger loins and meatier hams, etc., than a lard pig. And the lard pigs are kind of what are grown in Spain, in the Dehesa, and they produce a lot of, presumably they produce a lot of gene called SCD1. And what SCD1 is it turns saturated fat into monounsaturated fat. And so those lard breeds of pigs, typically their stored fat is high in monounsaturated fat and lower in saturated fats than the quote bacon breeds. And those lard pigs are also really good at doing, at basically turning starch into fat. So they're good at converting these, you know, acorn, the starch in it, because acorns do have a fair amount of fat, but they're mostly starch. And so what these lard breed of pigs are going to be doing is they're going to be converting a lot of that starch from the acorns into some saturated fat and mostly monounsaturated fat. And so in a pig like that, that can produce a lot of its own fat, you're going to get this kind of blend of the fat from their own de novo lipogenesis and the fat from the acorns. And acorns are actually more, they're closer to something like olive oil than they are to something like soybean oil in terms of their fat composition. Like they might only be 20% polyunsaturated. And so even the fat that you're getting from the acorn oil isn't nearly as much polyunsaturated fat as you would get from something like corn oil or soybean oil. And so
to me, that's good news because it means I can feel okay about eating the Iberico ham.
Right. And so the ham on the fat on those pigs, I believe is probably not I think the polyunsaturated fat level, I think I've seen is almost similar to like an American corn finished pork that doesn't have any supplementary fats. Like one thing that's happened in the US that's been very bad is we switched to doing this ethanol for fuel in our cars production. And what happens in these ethanol plants is they take in all this corn and they remove the starch and then they feed all the leftovers back to the pigs. And so when you remove the starch, you're essentially concentrating the oil in the corn. And so the pigs fed this dried distiller's grains, you know, instead of being 10% polyunsaturated fat, they might be 20% polyunsaturated fat. And the other thing that's happened in America is the new modern, you know, in the 90s in America, we had this advertising campaign for pork and they were calling it the other white meat and talking about how lean it was. And so they changed pig genetics in the early 90s to make it ultra lean. And what they actually did, it turns out, they didn't do this on purpose. They just used classical breeding techniques. But after they bred these really lean pigs, they were like, I wonder why they're so lean. And they looked and it turns out they had actually downregulated all of their genes that do de novo lipogenesis. And so these ultra modern, ultra lean pigs are not very good at converting starch to fat, which means that they're forced to get a higher percentage of fat from their diet, which means that on the same diet, they'll have a higher polyunsaturated fat content. And so the opposite argument is true about the pigs in Spain on the Dehesa. Those pigs are very good at making their own fat. So they're going to get a lesser proportion of fat from their diet, you know. So if you gave the white pigs and the Iberico pigs the same amount of polyunsaturated fat in their diet, the Iberico pigs are going to end up way lower than the lean white pigs.
That's fascinating. And it's interesting because I supply my sugar-free ice cream into several farm shops, and I was in one that's close to my home and talking about my intentions to make cured meat and sell it, and about what you're doing in America. And the farmer said, you know, take away some of the pork chops. He said, you know, we were talking about a chef that we both know, and how he impressed the chef by taking one of the whole pigs down to the restaurant for him to have. And he said, it's a woolly pig. And I said, it's not a mangalitsa, is it? And he said, yeah. So I was already onto this because it's a kind of heritage breed that has extremely fatty belly.
And sure.
The mangalitsa that he raised are probably very low in linoleic acid. And the reason I say that is, not only is it heritage, which I didn't know would affect its de novo lipogenesis, so that the whatever starch it's eating is turning into saturated and monounsaturated, but this farmer also runs a fruit and veg distribution business. So any of the fruit and veg that's not going to be sold or used is just given to the mangalitsa. And so they'll have, you know, they'll crunch whole pineapples in one bite or whatever. And all of that's going into their diet too. So I took some of these pork chops away, and it was the best pork I've ever had. I left them to defrost to room temperature and just to check what the fat was like. And it was extremely firm and white still. It tasted, the protein was very sweet, and the fat, it was more like lamb chops. And I was shocked and stunned. So I'm going to work with this farmer hopefully on a project and try to start curing stuff. But you know, that was my experience recently of talking about what you're doing, and it's interesting how there's already people effectively doing that close by, just by using heritage breeds and not using commercial feed.
Right. Yeah. No. It's fantastic. And yeah. I mean, something like that. I mean. Right. If you can finish them on pineapples, they're almost not going to have any polyunsaturated fat. I mean, you know, so there are some classic ways of feeding pigs that result in very firm fat. One of them is sweet potatoes. And so in areas where they grow sweet potatoes, what you would do historically is you go out in the field and you dig up your sweet potatoes and you sell them, or you save them to eat or whatever. And then they would turn the pigs into the field, because inevitably the human harvesters would miss a bunch of the sweet potatoes, and then the pigs would finish, you know, the last part of their, they probably would have been raised on something else until the sweet potato harvest is ready. But then the last month or whatever, they just put them in the field and let them eat sweet potatoes. And if you look at the old literature from the, you know, the late 1800s, they would say that, you know, a great way, if you've been feeding your pigs corn and you want to firm them up before market, a great way to do it is finish them on a field of sweet potatoes. And so that was, you know, in a lot of, I think I talked about this recently, but when you look at Chinese pigs, you know, the Chinese grow tons and tons of sweet potatoes, and they often, you know, they're, despite the fact that they're using a lot more commercial re-raised pigs now, I think even to this day, more than half of the pork in China is produced by very small farms. You know, people producing like 10 pigs a year or less even has a huge chunk of the Chinese market. And I think that's what a lot of them were doing, is you know, finishing them on the cull sweet potatoes, you know, the ones that you can't sell, finishing them on the ones left in the field, or you're growing rice, and you're getting the rice polished. So you're getting it made into white rice. And then, what they do is they separate out the, like the broken kernels of rice and the small kernels of rice. And so you might have a homestead, you take your rice to market, you know, they polish it, they take the whole kernels, and then they give you back the broken pieces, which they don't want to sell commercially. And then you take those and you, you know, you finish off your two pigs that you grew as a cash crop, and then you send those two pigs to market. So they're basically finished on white rice. So there's a lot of these little historical, diets that will give you really firm pork, you know, grain, interestingly, most of the fat, most of these polyunsaturated fats live in the outer membrane of the grain or in the germ. So another thing to think about is, you know, for human diets, when you make white rice or when you make white flour, in addition to removing, you know, a lot of the B vitamins and also a lot of the lectins and the things that could cause us some problems, we're also removing a lot of the vegetable oil from those grains. And like historically in the US, obviously corn was domesticated in Mexico and was eaten by Native Americans, obviously as a staple or as a seasonal thing, depending on what part of America you were in. But they made something called hominy, where you actually soak the grain in lye, or they would use wood ashes to create an alkaline solution. And you soak the corn in that overnight. And then in the morning you remove the skins and you remove the germ. So when you eat a corn tortilla made from masa dough or nixtamal, as they called it, you're also removing the vegetable oil from the corn. Interestingly. And so there's a lot of ways historically that one, you can make this low poofa pork, but it's also interesting to see native peoples going through this very traditional process that's removing the polyunsaturated fats from the grains they were eating too. And yeah, I just think there's just a lot of different angles when you start looking at this historically that all kind of start to line up, right? It's like, but I mean, that's great. I mean, if you can find, I guess the reason I brought up the sweet potatoes is that sweet potatoes are very low in fat, just in general. So sweet potatoes make very firm pork. Pineapple.
Because you're just driving the de novo lipogenesis in the pig, and that's it. That's where all the fat's going to be coming from.
Exactly. And the same thing, if they're eating pineapples, is going to be true. They're going to take that sugar, they're going to do de novo lipogenesis, and they're going to make... yeah, saturated and monounsaturated fat. So anything, right. So there's a lot of different ways. You know, in theory, you could fatten pigs on masa dough, right? Masa flour made from corn. You're still feeding them corn, but that would also make really firm pork because the fat is removed when you take the germ off the corn. Same thing. I mean, you could raise pigs on white flour and it would make a really firm pork, or even
croissants.
Yeah, croissants, or even as I see in the tropics, they raise them on just on like raw sugar or sugar cane, which is a high energy crop. And, you know, that's what they have there, right? So that's what they feed the pigs. And that would also make a really firm pork. And so, you know, there's a lot of different things. You know, beets would be another one, like sugar beets would make another firm pork. So there's a lot of things that you could finish a pig on, but obviously most of the time, commercial feeds are going to be the most available and the most economical way to finish pigs. But another classic one in the US, and I think they grow these in, I know they grow these in France, is Jerusalem artichokes, or also called sunchokes. But this is a type of sunflower, and it's a perennial, and it grows a tuber under the ground, and they look like little potatoes. They don't taste like much to humans, but you know, farmers would grow fields of this stuff in the 1800s, early 1900s, and then you would just put your pigs in there to finish at the end of the year. And that's another root crop that doesn't have any fat in it to speak of, that would make a really firm pork, and pigs love them and will dig them up, and they're easy to grow, and they essentially grow so tall and thick they'll choke out weeds once you get them established. And so I've actually always wanted to grow a couple fields of Jerusalem artichokes and try finishing pigs on that. This is a, like I say, it's tried and true. It definitely works. I just never quite found the time and the energy and the money to do it, but I've always thought it was a good idea. If somebody wanted to do Jerusalem artichoke finished pigs, I think that would be great. So there's a lot of different things. You can't grow pineapples in Scotland, I assume.
I think you could try, but you wouldn't get very far. I'm kind of longer term. I would love to have a small farm, which, even if it's a social enterprise, to teach people about all this stuff and make people feel a bit closer to where the food comes from. And I think there's a bit of the pendulum swinging back, which is good. You know, it's gone a wee bit far in terms of people thinking that any meat is going to be disastrous to the environment, and now people are realizing actually it's not the cow, it's the how, and it's, you know, there's ways of creating a really nice sustainable circular economy around livestock. And just like you're talking about in China, you know, the idea of, yeah, if you went to, you know, pretty much anywhere outside the cities in China and tried to suggest that we should stop rearing animals for food, then not only would you ruin people's lives financially, they would, you would clearly see that you were eliminating something which is in harmony with what's going on around these people. So I'd love to develop that further. And, you know, today was a great starting point talking about how pigs and chickens can be raised so that they continue to provide reasonably priced meat, but at the same time aren't going to harm people. So I appreciate you kind of getting into that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun. It's going to be fun going forward as we kind of think more about, yeah, sort of completing that circle, right? I mean, I know one of the things that certainly happened here in the US, and I'm sure that it probably has in Europe and Scotland as well, is this kind of separation of, like, if you look in 100 years ago, most farms had livestock and row crops that they would grow together. And so you understood that you needed the horse to plow the field, and then you grazed your cattle and pigs on the field, and that was manure for the next crop, and then you planted your crop, and it was this kind of long-term rotation of animals and plants. And that's gotten separated over the last 100 years, so that now farms are specialized. You're either a specialized row crop producer or you're a specialized livestock producer, and the row crops are all grown with synthetic fertilizers, and the manure from the animals is like a waste product that people are like, how do I get rid of this stuff? And it's polluting rivers. You know, we have in North Carolina, the hog industry has become very concentrated, and they have these huge hog feeding facilities, and then they have these lagoons of manure outside of the hog buildings. And then guess what? North Carolina gets hit with a lot of hurricanes, and every time they do, the rivers flood, and all of these hog manure lagoons get flooded, and it all just floats into the rivers. You know, and so you see real environmental problems from this concentration. Now, that's a very hard problem to fix, because you've got a lot of entrenched money and power wanting those industries to be what they are. So, you know, that's perhaps an insurmountable task, but you know, that doesn't mean that we can't start building small solutions, coming up with better small solutions and talking about it and growing it, because, you know, we don't know what could happen in another 100 years, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, appreciate what you're doing. And, you know, I appreciate you going into depth about your understanding of the reason that the type of fat really matters. Maybe I can have you back in the future and we can catch up again. But in the meantime, where can people find you online?
Sure. So my blog is fireinabottle.net. And my kind of meat site where I sell the pork is firebrandmeats.com. And the best place to follow me is if you're on Twitter, I'm fire_bottle. But there's also a conversation about the issues around the hyperlipid blog and the saturated fats and the whole thing on Reddit at reddit.com/r/saturatedfat is a really good one. And I am also on Facebook and Instagram, although admittedly I don't keep up as well with those accounts as I should if I had all the time in the world. But I think it's just called Fire in a Bottle on both of those sites as well.
Okay, fantastic.
Trying to think if there's anyone else that I should mention or throw out a thing, but I think that's most of it.
Okay, cool. Well, I appreciate what you're doing and thanks again for joining us, Brad.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's fun.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and see you next time.